I think we would all pretty much agree with the idea we are living in some contentious times. Fear and hateful words and suspicion and distrust seem to fill the air we breathe. You can't get away from it. You find it on the news, you go to Facebook and find it there. Even a conversation at work all seem to involve some kind of conflict. There are those that approve of President Trump and those that do not. There are those in favor of immigration and pro-DACA and those who want to stop the flow of immigration, at least from certain countries. There are those in favor of gun ownership and those who call for restrictions. There are the LGBT and their allies that call for full rights and participation, and those who want to exclude or even reject such people. And, well, I could go on. There's this long list of topics that already divides people, and the list seems to be getting longer all the time. But what is far more disturbing, at least for me, is the strength with which we hold on to these convictions. We become so entrenched and dug in and determined that anybody who does not agree with us must be wrong. And this way of thinking creeps into the church as well as everywhere else. And this is what makes the words of Jesus seem so striking. He says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." He says, "Love one another as I have loved you. This is my commandment." And he says, "Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you." Jesus preached a gospel of grace and radical love. He offered forgiveness even to those who put him to death on a cross. So what then are we to do with this? Well, I suppose we might say that Jesus' way of loving enemies and making peace is something that he could do, but not us. Jesus might be able to preach and live that sort of way, but it won't work for us, not today. But then stop for a moment to consider the world in which Jesus was born and lived, and you'll find it wasn't any less challenging than the world in which we live today. There was military rule, there was violence, there was rival and competing religions and politics that deeply divided people in the first century. It certainly wasn't easier to live a life of peace back then. And if we're inclined to think that the sort of life that Jesus talked about was only possible for him and not for mere mortals like us, then we're left to wonder why he spoke about this so often, both to the crowds and his disciples. He regularly called people to take up a new way of living. And he invited people to follow his example rather than just give witness to what he did. You wouldn't tell people to do something if it was impossible for them to do so. Now, if that's not troubling enough, you'll notice that this sort of talk of peace and love isn't limited to just Jesus. We keep bumping into it again and again in the New Testament. For example, when the Apostle Paul wrote to believers in Corinth, he was speaking to those who were already deeply divided. The believers there were fighting among themselves about who was more spiritual, who was more authentic in their faith, who was more gifted than the rest. You know, things got so out of hand there in Corinth that there were even some that broke in and took all the communion elements before the people gathered for worship. And they got drunk and they fed themselves with all the bread before anyone else could share in communion. Wow, that's a church that's in a mess, don't you think? And yet Paul speaks to these very people a message of love. He invited them to take up a more excellent way of acting towards one another. He invited them to make a choice. And so we have this passage, 1 Corinthians 13. We hear the passage read at weddings, and so we may think of it as a description about how husbands and wives are to live together. But you know, Paul was talking about how everybody is to behave towards one another, not just two people in a marriage. Paul wrote to people who were deeply divided. He knew his readers had their own interests and rivalries that fueled their feuding. They'd been busy trying to say that some were more important, more holy, more right than others, more deserving than the rest. And knowing all of this, Paul wrote to them to say, "Let me show you a more excellent way, the way of love." And then he describes it. Love is patient and kind. Love is not arrogant or boastful or rude. Love does not strut, does not have a swelled head. It doesn't force itself on others. Love does not insist on its own way. Neither does it keep score of the sins of others or revel when others are cast down. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. So take it from the Apostle Paul or from Jesus himself. Love is not an emotion that might sweep over us. Rather, love is a choice we make about how we're going to get along with others. You and I can choose to love others, even those we disagree with and those that won't love us back. After all, Jesus said, "What credit is to you if you only love those who love you already?" Anybody could do that. You're called to take it a step further. You see, love is a choice, not a feeling. Christian love, the sort of love that Jesus talks about, is the deliberate, conscious choice about how we're going to get along with everybody. Not just our spouse, but also with our parents, with our children, with the people at work, with our neighbors, the people in the church, even with strangers we may never meet. It's how we choose to get along with those who are like us and those we enjoy being with, as well as those who disagree with us and those we find disagreeable. The love Jesus talks about is a turning the other cheek kind of love, a going the extra mile sort of love, a loving those who won't love you back sort of love. That kind of love involves a conscious and intentional decision on our part. It will not flow from us naturally or easily, but it will flow from us when we make a choice to follow Jesus Christ. So what then about all these difficult and contentious matters I mentioned earlier, those things that might drive us apart? Now, I don't intend to resolve the conflicts we're facing. I don't expect to somehow make all the differences among us disappear. And I'm pretty sure I can't get you to believe what I believe. But here's what I can do. As your pastor, I'm going to try a couple things. I'm going to give you an observation, and then I'm going to point out a few warning signs that we could all pay heed to. And then I'll end with a few suggestions of things that we can do that will make for peace. So here's my observation. You might want to get out a piece of paper and pen for this, because this might just be profound. Who knows? Here's the observation. The only person in the world that you can ever hope to change is yourself. Not your spouse, not your children, not your boss, not your neighbor. The only person that you can really hope to change is you. That's my observation. Now, it's easy to forget this, and it's even easier to ignore. But nevertheless, it's proven true over and over again. The only person you can ever really change is yourself. Now, I have a few warning signs to heed if you hope to avoid destructive conflict. When conflicts arise, most of us tend to fall into certain traps. And when we fall in those traps, we undermine our ability to find peace and to practice love. So if we can be aware of the warning signs to kind of flag us off from where those traps are, then we might be able to act out of our fuller, kinder, more Christian self. I particularly think the warning signs come out in our language, the words we say, and the way in which we put words to what's going on. So I have four warning signs in mind. First, pay attention to the times when you are exaggerating the faults of others while minimizing your own. Watch out for language like this. She did a terrible thing. He's the one that's at fault. I did nothing wrong. You know that kind of language? That kind of language is a verbal cue that we're no longer engaging the conflict well. We're reacting. We are exaggerating the faults of others and minimizing any role that we have in the conflict. When we take on such language, that's a pretty good indication we're no longer free to consider the options that are available. We're no longer thinking of alternatives. It means that we're not taking an honest look at ourselves and the ways that we have contributed to the present situation, or the ways that we might contribute to a solution. So watch out for exaggerated language. Also, here's a second warning. Watch out for when we attribute ill motives to other people. We are headed for trouble when we assume to know what's in the hearts and minds of others without bothering to ask. This is particularly troubling when we assume the worst about others rather than the best. We might, for example, convince ourselves that somebody's really trying to get us, to embarrass us, to make us look bad in front of friends or coworkers. We might leap to the conclusion that somebody wants to hurt us or take something from us, but we really can't know what's in the minds and hearts of someone else, particularly if we don't take the time to ask them. Leaping to conclusions about the motives of other people is a pretty good sign that we are contributing to the problem rather than working to build peace and mutual understanding. All right, how about a third warning sign? This is when we straight take on strong polarities. We might call this binary thinking. But a warning sign is when our language starts to be reduced to just two choices: right, wrong, friend, enemy, good, bad, win, lose. Rarely are things in this world just one way or the other. When we start to think in such stark, absolute contrasts, that's an indication that your mind is already set and there's no room for nuance or other possibilities. It's a good indication that you're operating out of fear or anxiety or anger rather than out of creativity or love or self-confidence. I'll offer one more warning sign. That's when we overgeneralize. When you start to see people based on a label rather than see them as a full, rich, and complex person. That's an indication that you're moving away from peacemaking. When you see someone as standing in for a whole group of people, you no longer see that person for who they are. You see them as a label, as a stereotype. Now, what I mean by labels? Well, gay, straight, conservative, liberal, NRA member, abortion rights advocate, undocumented immigrant, you get the idea. Now, sometimes labels can be useful, I understand. But when we use labels to define people, we can quickly move to thinking there is no more to another person than simply the label they've been assigned. And it's not very difficult to go on from there to reject anyone associated with a label that we don't care for. Then we're no longer treating a person as a person. We are beginning to treat that person as an object, as something, someone less than fully human. When one group starts to talk about people in another group in ways that are demeaning or vulgar or objectifying, we should stop and take notice. When we ourselves engage in language that is dehumanizing, guess what? We end up diminishing our own humanity as well. When we reduce Muslims to people who are terrorists, when we say Mexican people are illegals or animals, when we reduce police officers to pigs, it says nothing at all about the people we are attacking. But it does, however, say a great deal about who we are and the degree to which we are acting with integrity and a heart of peace. Well, all this sounds good, I suppose, but what's it like in real life? Let me give you an example. When my son was in high school some years ago, particularly in about his junior or senior year, there were some disagreements we had about curfew. It was not unusual for him to be out on a Friday night or a Saturday night with friends, and oftentimes he had friends that were, you know, maybe a 25 or 30-minute drive from our home. And he'd be out with his friends, and then he'd call home about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, sometimes even a little later. And he'd been saying that it's late and he's having a good time, and why doesn't he just make it easy on us and stay over at a friend's house, come home the next day? Well, that's the way he phrased it. But my response was to get irritated. He knew we wanted him home at a certain time, and he'd agreed to our conditions, our request. There was no misunderstanding about what we expected of him, but then we'd get this phone call and he'd try to get us to give in to a whole different set of plans, namely his set of plans. Well, we had our objections both to the specific request, but also we didn't want to get into this whole protracted discussion every weekend about when he was to get home. We'd set a time and he needed to abide by that. And so we'd say no. And then our son would push back, saying we were unreasonable. Nobody else's parents had a problem with this. He told us that we should trust him, that after all, we'd brought him up to be a trustworthy person. And so we should trust him on these things. By the way, our son is a particularly energetic negotiator. And he has many rhetorical skills to his credit. Perhaps being the son of a teacher and a preacher has something to do with this. But after a bit of back and forth between us, you know, I would find that I would go from being irritated to being angry. I felt that our son always seemed to be trying to pull one over on us. That's exaggeration on my part. I thought he was testing our patience and boundaries. I felt he was deliberately trying to take advantage of us. I was attributing ill motives to him. I began to feel it was a contest of wills, a competition with a winner and a loser. And as the dad, it was my job to lay down the laws. That's kind of this polarity and binary thinking thing. And I found my voice would get louder, and I would lose my patience and ability to come up with more creative and useful options. I thought he needed to be taught a lesson about who was really boss. And so I tried to tighten the reins and take away privileges and make things harder. Looking back, I realized this really was a pretty typical part of parenting a teenage son, particularly the oldest son in the family. A teenager is going to want to have more and more independence. They're going to want to test the boundaries. They're going to want to have some decision-making on their own. It wasn't that he was being dishonest or untrustworthy or manipulative. There wasn't any character flaw within him, no great moral deficit. It was part of who he was and part of what he was going through. And I needed to kind of figure out my role as a dad in all of this as my role was changing. Now I recognize that the way I responded to that situation was really to react and get defensive and come down hard when I might really have recognized something larger that was going on and been more creative and been more open and more willing to recognize ways that we could address the issue and yet not get into conflict. So, I've given you an observation. I pointed out some warning signs to follow and or to watch for, that is. And I've even done a little personal confession up here. I'd like to finish up with three practical suggestions that we all might follow to put peacemaking into our lives. You know, we all know the song, Let There Be Peace on Earth, and I bet we could all join in that wonderful sentiment of having peace be our way in the world. But the song doesn't tell us very much about how to make it happen. So let me make just a few suggestions along that line. First, we need to start with ourselves, recognize what's going on inside our own head and heart, be mindful of what you bring to your interactions with other people, and how your own person might shape the ways that you understand and interact with another person. I think part of paying attention to yourself is to recognize those ways in which you might become anxious or fearful or mistrusting. And all those emotions, although they're very real, they can get in the way of really being a peacemaker. So to kind of recognize them and allow yourself to have some measure of control over those emotions rather than let them control you. I think the other thing about working on our own issues here is that we need to be willing to make a change in ourselves before we ever invite a change in others. So the first idea is to start with yourself. The second idea is to recognize that there are very few situations where there is a disagreement where it will be resolved because you give somebody else more information or a clever explanation. Just because somebody has a different point of view doesn't mean that they're ill-informed or that you need to set them straight. One last thing I would mention. We can work on building relationships with people rather than just forming opinions about groups of people you don't personally know. You know, it's easy to hate people that are strangers. That's part of the problem with social media today. We can unleash all sorts of messages without ever really engaging with the person on the other end. We don't really have a way to recognize the impact of our words or to rein it in when we may need to do so. It's easy to hate strangers, But it's very hard to hate people that you've come to know personally. Building relationships can go a long ways towards breaking down prejudice and fear that comes with the unknown. So, friends, love is a choice we make. It's a path that we might take in this world. It comes with our decision to follow Jesus. He showed us the way, and he helps us walk down that path. We have to work to make it happen. We have to work to make room for peace and to practice love as Christ commands, because these things won't come automatically or easy. We need to challenge ourselves to live by a higher standard, what Paul calls a more excellent way, the way of love that is revealed in Jesus Christ. But we can make deliberate and prayerful choices. We can pay attention to the warning signs that come along, and we can also work and do the things that would make peace more possible. Then the world will know us by our love, and we will all know the blessing that comes when we work for peace. Amen.